Hello, everyone. So the lecture today deals with the questions of organizational culture, gender, and diversities within organization theory. And they all are somehow related to each other, at least in the way I talk about them, because I mean, gender, we cannot understand it without seeing that it's a cultural concept. It's not only physical concept, but a cultural concept. And also diversities within organization theory are somehow combined to culture. And they become diversities, they become minorities, majorities, whatever, only in relation to some kind of cultural understanding. Cultural research started a few decades ago, around 1980, and forward it has been, in fact, quite a central concept in organization theory. And there were scholars like Andrew Pettigrew, Linda Smerci, Martha Kallas, Edgar Schein, Joanne Martin, Mary Jo Hatch, Monica Costera, Hugo Lettich, Mats Alvesson, Barbara Czarniawska, Pasquale Cagliardi, Silvia Gerardi, Feldman, Quinn, Geert Hofstede, Gunda Barley, Carl Weick, Albert Mills, Jean Helps Mills, Heather Hubble, Parkin, etc. Just to say a few names that are often mentioned when we study how cultural research has get started. One central question that has been in the starting point of organizational culture studies has been its understanding as cultures or as something that have cultures. And that's one article that's been delivered to you by Linda Smerci, article from 1983 in Administrative Science Quarterly. And it is exactly this issue. And it has been very central. And even you can see that quite often this special article is referred also in research. So it means that if we see that organizations have a culture, it is something very objective, and that we can define very easily. Whereas if we see that they are cultures, it's more a kind of anthropological concept, pointing out that organizations are cultures exactly the same way as some other parts of the society. So societies can be cultures, we can have villages, we can have city cultures, popular cultures, culture for youngsters, whatever. I mean, but it's exactly the same way that there are social issues that somehow combine and make the organization a culture. So this is the organization is culture understanding. So they are cultural phenomena and arenas for cultural activities. And at the same time, they are also producing culture to the society. I mean, we can hardly go anywhere without seeing that there is features of organizations, advertisement, whatever. It is part of everything that we see nowadays in environment. And And also culture and symbolism are related, they are talked related to each other. We can study individuals in cultural contexts, and we can understand that individual somehow always have this cultural context. It's very difficult to talk about individual without environment somehow. People are born and then they are educated, they are raised up with some kind of cultural context. Everything that we learn is somehow related to culture. And organizations are that kind of sites of culture as well. They are somehow building our understanding about gender, about leadership, about work, about products, anything. And symbolism means that at the same time organizations are symbolic. For instance, any CAO is representing some kind of symbolism for the organization. He or she can be old or young, or gender matters, education matters, whatever can be there at the background. And also presidents are very much kind of symbolic artifacts for the nations, as we can see in United States or wherever. So there is a lot of symbolism at the background. And cultural products might be such things like gender, age, race, ethnicity, all these diversities. They are also cultural products and based on cultural processes. And if we go to the cross-cultural understanding of organizations, it means that every nation also has its history, has its background, and somehow there is cross-cultural understanding how people do in East and West and Asia and Europe or wherever. So, and that is maybe very crucial part of organizational culture studies as well. Well, about science administration, there is also a journal called Culture and Organization. And SCOS is a conference organization every year about that is especially focused on cultural issues and organizations, and this special journal also is a good arena to read research on culture and organization area. The basic idea behind organization culture study is to understand organizations as some kind of micro-level unities that can learn, share, develop, get inherited, have memory, can even forget or create. So of course it is a conceptual collective concept. There is nothing similar kind of thing as an individual is that we study, but we can talk about organizational memory, for instance, as a kind of metaphorical concept even. So this collectiveness is somehow at the heart of organizational culture and how we define it. Also, a very old subject of study has been within organization theory, the place of the individual in organization studies and in organizational contexts. So what is the place of the individual? Is it kind of place for conflicts, or is it a place for harmony? Anyway, there is some dynamics between the individual and the organization. For instance, individuals are creative, but can they be creative in organizational contexts? Is it possible? And if they are, who owns their creativeness? Example of this would be, concrete example of this would be a patent. If people are working for the organization and their work gets patented, so of course, it's the organization that owns the product, not the individual. And sometimes it's also regulated very much. You cannot leave the company with your creative ideas. You cannot go to the competitor with your creative ideas, and you have to wait until 3 years or something like that before you can do that. So it's also quite interesting subject of research somehow, very basic subject. What is the place of the individual at the organizational context? And how we define this collectiveness and what kind of problematic there is behind. Well, then about organizational culture, it is about several issues. I mean, it has brought into the study fields values, attitudes, organizational history is important. What is the place of that? At the organizational outcomes, for instance, how the history is somehow forming the company and the organizational culture. Somehow it gets possibilities, but at the same time it makes some ways to do things impossible. So It is both. So it supports and it gets limits to the things and work within the company. What is the history? Then traditions. I mean, there are many traditions that are at the heart of organizational culture. I mean, in Finland, it's a tradition of Little Christmas, and there are parties for newcomers and parties for those who leave the companies. Very typical parties for organizations that they are somehow they represent their cultures using these traditions. Also, many routines and rules and norms are somehow part of organization culture. They also define what is possible and what is not possible. And rule is somehow like Emily Durkheim was studying rules at the very, very ancient times in organizational theory. And somehow it was defined that organizations are in a way based on rules. Without rules, it would be chaotic and it would not be any kind of organization. And also it is not something that is very opposite to creativeness, because as many researchers emphasize, for instance, James March, that we need routines in order to be creative. If there are certain routines, if there is certain kind of stableness, then we can build up our creativeness on that kind of stable work habits. There are also control systems. They can be present also for creativeness, because for instance, remote work, it's easier to do remote work if there are control systems and it is controlled what is your productivity, I mean, at the individual basis. It was earlier times that the leaders needed to see that their workers were really working, but nowadays, in the times of remote work, it's the other way around. It's other systems that do this and not the leader who is somehow controlling concretely the work at the organization. Also, structures of organizations are important. We can read much about organization seeing their structural charts. For instance, so what are the responsibilities and what is the leadership and management style there, and we can learn about structures, and they have of course a lot to do with the routines and rules and everything. So of course these are quite much combined together, even if they are, we can talk them also separately. Then about stories and narratives, it's very much at the center of how organizations work, how people work there. They use stories, storytelling and narratives. And we can learn about organizational ideals and values and ways to do things there, hearing the stories. And we are going to have a lot more about this part of organizations later, at the narrative part of the, this organization theory course. The social capital to end this organization culture definitions, it has to do with the collectiveness. It somehow gathers together the social part of the organization. It is saying that it's not only financial capital that is important, but everything that is represented in social structure of the organization. I mean, networking and trust even is seen to build social capital at the organization. All that is quite a collective metaphor, so to say, and very near to what we understand about organization culture, but not exactly the same, of course. Then, so far we have sometimes talked about organization culture as something that is quite harmonistic, probably, or kind of collective. We usually think that it's some kind of harmony if there is a collective. But Joan Martin, in her studies, and have used the concept of three approaches to organization culture, which somehow reveals the many levels of culture. We can use this kind of integration approach and see culture as a unity, kind of umbrella that unites things together and integrates things together. But almost the opposite is a kind of differentiation approach, which means that cultures are multiple, it's a lot of conflicting there, it's dynamics, it's competing spheres. If we read the company history, usually it's built on very much integration kind of approach, saying that history is, it is as it is, and they don't very often, those who write the organization history, they don't so often talk about the conflicts and fights and everything that is there that makes the history as it is. But anyway, this part is really, this is very essential in organizational culture. And of course, we can study this differentiation and this kind of more multiple understanding of cultures. And whereas compared to the first two, there is this fragmentation approach, and it is somehow identified within postmodernistic understanding of organizations. So it sees cultures as a continuous process. So it is somehow more interested in, well, this kind of study approach, more interested in stories, narratives, how they build the culture. And they are very much saying that organizations are cultures and they cannot be talked as they have some cultures, but they are based on continuous processes, and those processes somehow carry and build up what the organization really. Then levels of organization culture by Edgar Schein, who was one of the first scholars in this field. Well, he defines organization culture using three levels, and the first is artifacts. So it is about the visual structures and processes, saying that there is this artifactual part of organization. When we go into the building of an enterprise, we get certain image which kind of place it is. And probably this artifact is telling something about the culture, something about what the organization is producing, for instance. Well, industrial buildings may be very different compared to other buildings. And so there are many visual structures and processes which are portraying somehow the company. And as I was talking about the symbolism and CAOs as part of the artifactual nature organizations, that means exactly that they are also somehow visual part of the organization, and it matters who they are. Of course, their expertise matters. It's the first thing, but there is also this artifactual issue as well in big companies. Then there is this value part. There are strategies, goals, philosophies, and that is at the heart of organizational cultures that Edgar Schein was focusing. And they somehow, we can read artifacts having these values beyond somehow. So if artifacts and values are very much different, if artifacts are telling very much different issues compared to the values, so that's probably a bad issue for the organization and the company productivity. So if it is a very progressive organization that wants to progress feministic values, so it would be impossible to have there probably a person who is not having any kind of values like this, or that is very, very much different symbolically compared to this, or whatever. So we all the time read organizational world in terms of artifacts, in terms of values, and somehow see their being together. Of course, it's surface level, and we cannot say it's the first. It's difficult to say what is the most important and so on, but of course, expertise and knowledge and all that is there, and values, artifacts are somehow beyond that all. It's very difficult to somehow separate them altogether. Then Erika Schein also talks about basic assumptions, that there is this unconscious, taking for granted beliefs, perceptions, thought and feelings that is even beyond values. And he talks about that organizations might have their own time concept. Very often it's a kind of tradition or habit to start meetings quarter past. If it is said that meeting starts 2 o'clock, it means probably 1:15 for the insider of the culture. And many other kind of things, and also rhythm of organizational life goes, at least in Finland, we have the vacation times which are important for people, and somehow people have this rhythm of organizational life that is based on that. But of course, not all organizations have similar kind of time concept. They differ, they cannot do the same. Sometimes it's easy to have vacation in summer, sometimes it's not easy to have vacation at summertime, for instance. Then there are the levels of culture, kind of onion metaphor about these core assumptions, values, and artifacts and behaviors of organizations. Then Mary Jo Hatz is talking about cultural dynamics in her classic article about cultural change in organizations, saying that it's not also one, it's not an integrative concept. It has many levels, and at the same time, it's a changing concept. And she tries to understand these cultural dynamics somehow, values, symbols, artifacts, assumptions, and how comes the realization and symbolization, for instance, artifacts and symbolism, it's they there is this symbolization between those two, and values and assumptions, there is manifestation, and values realize themselves in artifacts, etc. So that's also part of the classic theory or organization culture. And there are a few other concepts like identity, culture, and image. So identity came later in the vocabulary of organization culture and theory. So identity is something, if we say it simply, it's how we see ourselves or how the organization sees itself. And reputation is more about image, how other people see, how employees see, how we want others to see us. So it is something we can even manipulate reputation. And it's a big issue sometimes nowadays. Politics, for instance, they are seen to manipulate their reputation, say to someone, please tell audience that kind of story about myself, for instance. So that's not very fair. People don't like that kind of manipulation ever. And it's also the same in organizations, that it's not a place so much for manipulation, but there should be some real relation between what is, so to say, true, what is the objective state condition at the enterprise, and what is its reputation. And also culture is there, it becomes near to identity. It's kind of guide for decision making, it's kind of way to do things around. It's a kind of background somehow to organization, and it's more probably concrete in that way. We understand the features of organization cultures as we talked some earlier. So identity research is also, it somehow has the individual part of it and the organizational part. We can talk about individual identity, seeing it as a kind of personal conception and expression of one's own self-identity. And we can recognize also others' individuality or national identity, for instance, cultural identity. And at the same time, it can be organizational identities, which are inner or outer. The inner is more something that is seen from the inside of the organization, and outside is seen from the outside of the organization. So it comes near to reputation concept. So identity, anyway, it realizes in relation to something. So it's kind of relational concept. Whereas self is more a kind of concept that is not so much seeing other people, but the person oneself. If we have the self, it's about our own subjective experience of ourselves, our emotions, perceptions, thoughts, how we see ourselves. And identity somehow stands at the intersection of self-perception and one's perception of the others. So it's somehow seeing how we see and how others see us. It's a relational, situated concept. It's very near to any cultural context. Whereas self is more subjective. Well, individuals, again, in the cultural context, there is a kind of personality and the individual within the cultural concept, and it somehow makes the identity. So the self and the cultural impact somehow, they are very much related. We cannot somehow separate them easily. And identity and cultural context is one big question in studies as well. So how we identify ourselves, how we become committed, for instance, for the organization, how we understand the others. And it is very much socially constructed. That is an important concept within cultural studies. So people somehow socially construct themselves in organizational spheres. And identity is somehow, they identify themselves also in this cultural context. Well, here is the Cultural and Organization Journal, by the way, which is about, which was founded just after the cultural debate in organization theory started. So identity and culture are very much near to each other. And if we read organizational research nowadays, the identity discourse is quite powerful there still. Then going to another issue that is about, that is more about diversity. So diversity management is based on the recognition and respect for individual differences. In fact, it started from this area or research from United States. It has always been there a very big issue because of equality reasons. United States has been a kind of smelting pot even for different nationalities, languages, ethnicity features and all that. So it's very natural that diversity management has been there a big issue, but it's also in anywhere else nowadays, also in Europe and other countries. So how should we deal with diversities and how should we be, promote equality in organizations? So other aspects of diversity include several things. So we have talked about gender, but there are also race, ethnicity, sexual orientation, socioeconomic status or class, so to say, physical abilities, religions, political beliefs, all that are diversities. And in general, we can say that tolerance and non-discriminatory practices of management, especially it is seen in human resource management, they belong to this area of diversity management studies. And it often includes recognizing minority issues and critical aspects like inequalities and discrimination and that kind of things. We can ask in diversity studies, who is the other? Who is marginalized? Who is at the center of knowledge? And I was mentioning about organizational theory books that there are special books even that are meant for being critical, saying that everything that has been written in organization theory has somehow ignored, for instance, gender or ignored some other minority, and they somehow make them the others that are at the same time marginalized. So it very often is a question of majority and minority and whose voice is to be heard and whose voice is not to be heard. And what are the conditions that we use when we somehow conduct a study? So are we at the same time ignoring some very important part of the organization? So paradigms behind diversity management. There is different paradigms even that can be seen in organizational practices, human resource management especially. And one is the kind of resistance paradigm. We see that diversity is not important, it is even denied, it is not existent. There are no programs or politics for diversity management. And that may lead to a kind of blind production of inequality if they somehow ignore issues that anyway are important for discriminatory policies. But then there is kind of discrimination justice paradigm that aims to equality and fair practices in organizations. And in companies, they want to emphasize policies where minorities get food space. So somehow give space for some special group of people. Sometimes in very companies with like engineering companies, there are hardly any women. Sometimes they get some special programs for women to make their career. I mean, consciously somehow be a bit discriminatory that way, that they somehow emphasize that this special minority, or maybe very young people, or maybe very old people, or some other group. That is important that these special groups get some special training, for instance, now in order to do better at the enterprise. Then there is kind of anti-legitimization paradigm. Who is the member of the organization? Who gets the legitimized position at the organization? And this kind of approach aims to support business that helps to maximize everyone's potential and give that some meaning. Focus on recruiting practices is typical in this third paradigm, because we ask how this organization is as it is, what are the members of that, and why there are so few other members. So in Finland, these equality programs that every bigger company should have, they somehow, this anti-legitimization paradigms is important there, because they follow up the numbers of newcomers, their gender, their career, their age and everything that, and try to see if there is some very discriminatory practices. So it's a kind of obligation given by the society for the enterprises to study their organization in terms of this. And then as a third, fourth paradigm, it's even a kind of learning efficiency paradigm, which stresses the relation that the diversity has to work, and organizational members are even kind of progressing the productivity. So diversity is somehow related to productivity, even say, like Nokia used to have, maybe still have, this big program for diversity. And they emphasized that because it was a global big company, so it was emphasizing that there is one company language, but it everyone can join the company and they are not discriminatory for any diversities at all there. So there is about this entry problematic a bit more detailed. So for instance, there might be very restrictive announcement for new jobs. Well, it's more and more common, it comes with from the networks, the announcements. But if only the informal recommendation matter, if the family members are giving privilege, that's usually nepotism and it's very harmful for the reputation. of any organization. Also, recruitment only from certain schools, especially United States, with so many, with several kind of universities, I mean. So if it is just legitimized some school, some university, usually in Europe, I think it's not such important issue. Then about using tests that are very much validated, so they should not be culture dependent and discriminating. So if we use tests in personal selection, we should use testing in the way that is undiscriminatory. And that means that they should be some validated, and they should have good research background, those tests. Also, inferior attributes from the person that are irrelevant for job demands is somehow describes this entry problem as is. So if the people who are asked if they, what are their family plans, for instance, or whatever might not be important at all for this person to fulfill his or her job, fine. So that would be even illegitimate. Gender discourse in administrative sciences started around 1980s, 85, and especially in organization studies, it was probably Rosa Petmos-Kanter, 1977. She wrote the book about men and women of organizations, and it was a kind of starting point for pointing out gender issues in organizations. And she was talking about women as a resource that has been neglected in organizations many ways, especially in management positions. And gender discourse, it broadens from understanding of sex to gender, so somehow from numbers to kind of social construction or reality, because gender is more kind of cultural concept. It means that we are socially constructed also by gender. So then gender discourse have all the time been powerful in studying equality issues, discrimination, and gender is seen as a kind of situated category, which is then also related to how environment is somehow defining gender, how gender is done in organizations. And femininity and masculinity studies are both there nowadays, maybe still, and yes, still more femininity studies. And feminism is a kind of shared intellectual discourse at the background that we can quite easily dig on. So theoretical roots of studies, also very cross-cultural, I mean sociology, psychology, political sciences, they all deal with the question of gender quite a lot. And it has been also a big part of administration and managerial studies these decades. And this kind of doing gender approach that I think is quite peculiar within this approach. So some kind of, like Linda Smertik and Martha Kalas are studying kind of, well, there are a few classics in this field. They are somehow studying different approaches within feministic studies and how they are applied in organizational sciences. And then gender and entrepreneurship and ethnographic approach by Silvia Serardi and Bocchio. They were studying about the femininity, masculinity, and also how entrepreneurship is a kind of discourse that is quite masculine in how it talks about entrepreneurs and they were somehow criticizing that it's somehow not very much involving kind of femininity or aspects of that are peculiar in femininity at all there, and that means that they are limited approaches for the women, even often. And stereotypes behind masculinity and femininity, that is somehow when we talk about entrepreneurship and this kind of masculinity discourse. So in fact, it's very much about stereotypes, because about masculinity stereotypes, then it's usually self assertion, separation, independence, control, competition, focused perception, rationality, analysis. Whereas in femininity, well, this is the famous Marshall definition, femininity is more about interdependence, cooperation, receptivity, merging, acceptance, awareness of patterns, emotions, holism, personalistic perception, intuition, syntax, very much the opposite somehow. And these stereotypes have been studied and how they are possibly changing and how they affect individual level experiences. And if they are very much hegemonistic, then we cannot see that there are many masculinities, many femininities, and also that gender is very much a discourse, that it's not stagnated to some kind of concept, and they are processes also at the organizational level that are somehow acting for femininity and acting for masculinity, and all the time breaking up even these stereotypes at the same time. Well, just a few words about feminism by very classic Sandra Harding's book about feminism and methodology. And Moi, What is a Woman, was also kind of philosophical understanding about feminism, and this old French women philosophers has been very much doing research at the background of this feminism discourse. So there have even been some kind of appraisal of objectivity discourse and epistemological, how to gain knowledge. We should, who is the subject of knowledge? Has it been the woman, or why woman has been marginalized as a kind of subject of knowledge? Marshall talks about in another voice about, can you trust the woman when she's an expert in strategical issues, for instance, or that way, or situational knowledge, how women are situated, and are they situated at family, with family issues, at home. If you see the business magazines from two decades ago, it was very often that they talked at the same time women's career as a manager and her family. Whereas when they talked about men's career as a manager, they didn't talk so much about his family at all, so it was separate. Well, that kind of issues have been even discussed and studied quite a lot. So how we produce gender, what kind of self-reflection there is at the background that we need to do this research, and what is the process. For instance, in qualitative studies and in studies that use art as data. For instance, how cultural national heritage can be seen in film industry, like it has been made analysis of Niskavuori films in Finland, how they represent gender and power structures in Finland 19th century, how gender is produced at the film, and well, how it reflects what is at the society, but how it also produced gender and how it changes it even sometimes. There is also this discourse on change and instead of stereotypes. And sometimes also feminism and political movements are at the study background. So how can we emancipate women? We can talk about developing countries where it's quite big discourse, how women's movements and feminism, in fact, how they can work as political movements for liberating women and somehow helping the nation to from poverty to some kind of more welfare at the national level. Well, to go on to the approaches, and this is especially Linda Smerczyk and Martha Kalas who have been talking these approaches, feminist approaches, and how they defined gender. Well, in liberal discourse, they define gender as a kind of neutral issue, saying that we should search for equality. It is important. It's a binary variable, this sex, and we should search for equality. And in fact, it has been very much the general tone in 90s and 80s political economy. Also, there is this radical kind of Swedish liberation movement, which is quite different. It somehow sees that sex class is oppressed, and there is the condition of women. There are also masculinity studies that have this point of view, that kind of men's liberation, but it's maybe minority, not so many, I can't remember, but there are that kind of approaches also. But anyway, how gender is a kind of social construction and how it subordinates probably women and what can be done in terms of that. And it's again this poverty and women in the developing countries. And often developing countries have been study object very often in feministic studies and this special approach. Also, socialist Marxist approach was very much it's like its own. The 70s was part of women's movement and somehow as historical criticism of class relations and oppression under capitalism and all that. I think that in, especially in that discourse, they saw that organizations are sites for reproduction of patriarchy and capitalism. And in fact, in Soviet Union, it used to be, for instance, very many women engineers because it was very consciously tried to be equal in education system. So they were also working for this. So it's part of the history as well. So also psychoanalytic studies that evolved from Freudian and other psychoanalytically orientated theories. They talk about gender structures as a social system of male domination, even it influences sexual development of people. It can be seen that female skills can be even advantage in organizations and it's talked about why they are not present there. And it's also many studies that are family-orientated, biography-orientated, which kind of biographies, for instance, women who had broke the glass ceiling, what are they, what kind of biographies they have, like Sanna Hyvärinen about many past due management and women managers' stories about their career, and many. So that's very special approach somehow. They study it differently, this gender aspect. And then there is still postmodern, post-structural, especially French post structuralists that have critiques about the knowledge and identity, who is the knower, and what is the gendered background of that knowing, seeing that sex and gender are discursive practices and they constitute specific subjectivities. And there is power always present when we make the definitions. And we should be aware of this kind of discourse also at the organizational level. Well, at last, there is this post-colonial approach that is emerging from gender critics of Western feminism, seeing that is, in fact, it's very much European tone in this feminism, seeing that this post-colonial critics of Western ways to gain knowledge and made concepts is important because this globalized economy and worldwide organizing principles are questioned and seen that we should also use this kind of post-colonial approach and be critical. And globalization has special gendered aspects that should be studied. For instance, probably this poverty issue again for, so to say, third countries. And gender question within them. Then there are four positions in women's studies. Somehow these four positions can emphasize the importance of studying, for instance, women management, very different way. This is this equal opportunities position that goes well to this equal discourse. That was a bit earlier here, which means the fair chance for women and men, and they are seen the same in a way. Whereas meritocracy critics say that we should have effective society and it should be gained using all the resources at the society. That was about what Rosabetos Kantel was talking about, why there are so few women in 1977 in company top management. And then there is a special contribution position, women make a difference even, or alternative values position. It's is that there is this radical perspective and alternative enterprises and leadership even, that women can establish enterprises for their own needs. Even, for instance, it was some enterprises in Finland that they're just for women's IT expertise or women's role in poverty in Africa or something like that. So there are special programs that somehow emphasize this special contribution or alternative value. And just a few words about bodily nature of organizations, because it's good to remember when we talk about gender, it's a cultural concept, but at the same time, it doesn't exclude somehow the bodily nature of people and organizations. So it can be also gender blindness that leads to invisibility of gender. And there is a big discourse nowadays about sexuality at the workplace because it has been seen that it's part of the power games at the organization. And this Me Too campaign was revealing these hidden power structures and the wideness of sexual disturbance at the organization. So it is a kind of discourse that is still quite broad there. And it talks about what are the company organization cultural habits there and which are tolerant and which are less tolerant. And should it be more equal so that men and women see it in a similar way somehow. So what looks innocent in organizational cultures often is really not that. That was really seen in Me Too campaign 1 year ago. So at the same time, when we use this gender approach, we can use other diversity types like ethnicity, age, class, race, and use this minority understanding within organization theory in a similar way. Gender and masculinity is just to emphasize it a bit also, that it means opening the hidden gendered meanings for masculinity and emphasize that it is a discourse and it is also not kind of hegemonity in that, but there are many masculinities and gender is part of both femininity and masculinity. And also critics of masculinity stereotypes somehow emphasize that it's authoritarianism, paternalism, careerism, etc. That are seen that they are at the center of, so to say, real or one masculinity. So, but they are more or less stereotypes. So this gender discourse opens up also critical aspects about masculinities and stereotypes about that. But just to end this part about gender in organizations and organizational theory, I would say that end up with Simone de Beauvoir, who is very prominent philosopher in this field, French philosopher, who is saying that the body is not a thing, but it is a situation. Body in the world that we are is an embodied intentional relationship to the world. So the body places us in the middle of many other situations. Our subjectivity is always embodied, but our bodies do not only bear the mark of sex. Our race is bodily situation. Class is a historical bodily situation. So that way it combines very nicely this kind of body and culture somehow, and the environment that is always conceptual, cultural by nature. Well, there is the special journal about gender work and organization, which talks these articles, it publishes articles around this area, so it's very prominent for people who work somehow in this aspect of gender in organizations. Then about age in organizational studies and as a part of diversity. And there are many similar kind of definitions and ways to think and open up the issue compared to gender studies when we go to age and culture in organizations. So people identify themselves in multiple categories, and age is one of the most crucial, as is gender. And we can also study age as from an angle of numbers, I mean chronologically. We can study also them in terms of discourses. How did we define people in terms of age, and how aging is diverse, and from a cultural point of view, it is also done in discourses. So it's aging is a social issue because networks and social practices will change during the life course, and people's knowledge and expertise face new situations and expectations always, and they face these expectations again and again, and they are profiled again and again. So identity for people has to do with aging. I think that identity also changes when people age. So it's much more than just numbers, how old you are in terms of numbers, but it has this old cultural background. And in fact, we were studying in a book edition by Albert and Jean Mills about aging organization and management. It talks very much about this aging from the cultural point of use, about cultural discourses and critical perspectives. Were around that area, the articles that were published in this book edition. So there are multiple age definitions, and they are also subjectively defined. So people have many ideas about their own age. There are definitions like ideal age, experienced age, and chronological age is only one dimension, even if we usually see it probably the only one. And studies have considered deeper background or images of aging in organizations, especially that relate to kind of cross-skilled cultural gender issues. I mean, in Asian cultural context, age have a different meaning compared to Western or United States. I think that in Asian context, age has always been, it has been respected more, it has been kind of more something that is well taken for granted or even seen in a kind of positive way, whereas in Western discourse usually age is not seen in such a positive context. Anyway, age is therefore a complex socially constructed concept. And it is also gender and country culture specifics on that. So aging as a research topic, the workforce in Europe is aging, and that is probably one of the issues that make aging a quite central object of research nowadays. Because in Europe, it was a baby boom after the Second World War, and it combined the current low birth rate nowadays. Whatever is the reason, I mean that now the big generation, baby boom generation, is getting older. And people also live longer in Western countries. So because of the medical healthcare and medical development, all that type of medicine. So people live longer. But this is really very Western idea, because I mean going to the Africa or even Latin America countries, it is not that way. In Africa, it is maybe other way around. There are more younger generations and children. At the living rates are not so high as in Western countries, but this is more about European research. So the need for the workforce to continue working in later life, it also has stressed the importance of working longer and how people would work longer, and it has been researched how to close the early exit rates and raise the employment levels of aging employees in European countries especially. And just like in gender research, it has been found out aging stereotype. There is an assumption of general decline in skills and abilities with increasing age. And it is often shown to be quite simplistic and incorrect. I mean that there is, first of all, there is very much individual difference. I mean, people age differently. Some people, even physically, are in a better state physically, and the others are probably not. It's a lot of genes that we have. I mean that everything that is inherited. So it's a lot of heterogeneity also in that sense. And there are stereotypical assumptions concerning aging employees, their work ability and job performance, which also influenced human resource practices and policies. And most often aging is seen in Western societies in the context of decline and deterioration, by Asian countries usually value it more, see it more positively. There is also some evidence that women are more inclined to social devaluation in aging compared to men, because of the women's value is more crowding in her appearance and reproductive prospects even. And there is also research on aging and men especially that somehow talks about different issues. And so when people age, also probably because of their gender, age management should recognize the gendered differences when people age, and they anyway should be part of organizations and they should have commitment and motivation to work there. And there are some summary of the studies relating to aging employees and human resource management. Well, what is seen there, that it's mostly the chronological aspect. It's not so much about this, how age is made in organizations, what are the discourses at the background, but like this Irni is talking something about the gendering practices in work organizations and somewhat more socially constructed way to understand aging. And it's more about aging retention, how to human resource management should recognize age in their practices. In these age management studies, just a few words about them. So there are these studies about age discrimination, how they may influence human resource management decisions. About entry problems, are older people seen not important when it is training for at the company? Are they seen that they are not potential for career planning, for instance? And this kind of management relies quite heavily on work ability studies, which explores changes in the health, functional capacity, work ability, work environment, and it stresses people that when they are over 45 years old, even it is some kind of aging point. Now when people live older, I think this is very low definition for aging. I think it's maybe they talk about 55 nowadays. It's after that people have maybe 10 or 15 years to continue in work life. So there is organization managerial support for people and who work longer, and it's in age management studies it is talked about that also, what kind of support people might need and how age generations differ. Also sometimes it is also for younger people. I mean, very often it is seen that very young people also get stereotyped because they are young and probably not knowing so much and not being so experienced and so on. And at the same time, the oldest part of the personnel is seen at the same time that they are somehow slipping out of the expertise, or somehow they become not to be seen at all at the organization. They are somehow at the limit of going out for retirement. But also in terms of management, it's not a very clever point to somehow ignore some of the expertise or talents or motivation at the company level. Well, retention studies especially talk about how which kind of practices somehow supports being staying longer in the work life, which kind of practices motivate older employees and mention just some issue there is that also older people, they have this family work life balance problems also, because nowadays older people have their older parents, and when they are almost 60 years old, they might have parents who are 90 years or 100 years old because they live older. So it's very often nowadays that they have both probably grandchildren and then older parents. So it's not so that it's only the people who are 40 years old or 50 years old, they have the family work-life balance problems and challenges, but it's also the older workforce. And also it is find out that the limit between retirement and work is not so, well it's flexible. I mean, many people also work after retirement, part-timely or as entrepreneurs. It's most often experts and professionals like lawyers, doctors, consultants who do this kind of work, and they can stay in work life quite long, in fact. Also, sometimes it may also be because of economical necessity, because in some countries the pensions are very low and people even have to work very long because of that. So there are many kind of needs for people, and it's not so simple that it's work and retirement. It's many combinations also. Then there are studies related to ageism. Age should not be mentioned at announcements for new jobs, either for young people or old people. You shouldn't announce mentioning that we need this and this age person, because it's kind of illegal in European Union at least. And it's also talked how this negative image of older employees might form a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy due to the mechanisms or stereotype treat, so that people are seen according to the stereotypes. So they start to behave like that. So that's again how to get people committed, motivated. Then they get older at the workforce. Then there are also some gender sensitive studies, which studies really how women and men make the difference. They are often qualitative studies and study how age is done, how gender is done. And this Irni's article that was at the reading list, it was especially about this, how women and men in various positions in Finnish organizations and job sectors, how they are treated and how they need resistance and practices, and it was explained in terms of individual gendering characteristics that was brought on by aging. So there are quite few studies like this that take the kind of making the age position, but there are some still. And they are often qualitative studies, because quantitatively they would be difficult, or numbers wouldn't be so important to use in this kind of studies. Well, also some practical views on aging, much that has to be gained if age is seen as multidimensional gendered concept. So this kind of crossing the concepts of gender, age, and other diversities might be quite much used in the studies nowadays. And just using this calendar age or chronological age in human resource policies might be stereotyping and not so much taking account the realities of the people who are aging and their individual differences, their individual motivations. So just for the summary, diversity study aims, and there is the diversity, equality, diversity and inclusion journal that is much around this area or research. So studying this area is a prominent journal to send the articles or read the articles from the others. So a few issues about diversity study aims. It's about diversity as a resource, not so much as a kind of limitation of it. Then it's about critical studies on diversity versus equality, kind of marginalism, and how studies should recognize that it's a lot of discriminatory practices that are important study field. Then power, minority aspects, human rights are at the center of many studies, and even emancipatory interest, which means that how we can promote practices that are supporting for people to work equally and to somehow meet with these challenges that come from the stereotypes and all that is related to diversity. And also that kind of research that has a special kind of emancipatory interest, they are within this study field and even part of academic studies, and sometimes seen in gender work and organization and equality, diversity and inclusion journals. Well, there are of course many other journals that talk about diversity issues in organization studies or whatever. Human relations, they all are prominent zones to search if you want to go further in this study field. So, thank you very much.